This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
KPFT Houston.
In keeping with KPFT's mission of bringing the voices of the community to you, here is one of your candidates in the upcoming election for local station board.
My name is Herbert Steptoe. I'm a volunteer and a longtime listener. Since I became an active volunteer in 2007, it has been a journey for me. I participated with the fund drives and the outreach events. I was voted in by the local station board to fill a vacant seat which expires this year. For the past several months, I've been working with a number of the committees. I wish to continue working to move KPFT forward in the coming years. I'm concerned about the success and future of KPFT. Please vote for me as candidate number one on your ballot.
That was a statement by Herbert Steptoe. For complete candidate statements and more information about all of your candidates for the local station board, please visit kpft.org. The future of KPFT and the entire Pacifica network now rests upon the participation of our listener members. This is KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
And Brian Levinka.
And Glenn Holt.
Tonight on the show, we're going to be talking with David Elliott from Washington, and he's going to be talking about gay marriage. Interesting case in Dallas that we're going to be talking about also included in that. Sue Lovell will be here in the second part of this hour. She is running for her last term as city council person for at large number two. And we'll be talking to her about her race and what she, you know, her accomplishments and some of the people she works with down at city council. In the second hour, we have...
We've got the minister, from Ernie Turner, from Baring Memorial Methodist Church, and we're going to be talking about the outreach because Baring is a reconciling congregation. And then after that, we've got a sisters will be here. Becky Earle, the vice president of finance with the sisters, will be here. We're going to talk about decadent desserts coming up this Sunday.
Well, there's a lot of things coming up this week, and I was really hoping to see Outsmart have it all sort of listed. But I'm sure they do.
Well, it's just we just
don't have the magazine yet.
Well, tomorrow is National Day Out, and a lot of local neighborhoods associations are doing sort of their events. Here in Avondale, they're doing one at the Lovett Inn, and you should check around and meet your neighbors and see what's going on in your neighborhood. Also, this weekend, there's a lot of things going on. The National March.
Yes, I will be going to D.C. to march for our equality in gay rights, and I'm excited.
Are you going
to
make it back to the show next Monday?
Yes, I'll be back, and we're going to do a wrap-up of the show, kind of our impressions.
Of the march, you mean?
Of the march, I'm sorry. And I'm going to try to bring two people that have never been to the march before to get their impression.
Oh, their first impression
of
being one. Oh, that's wonderful.
That's good radio. They're saying like 500,000 people are expected.
Well, and locally there's a lot of events going on. The community center is having their quarterly get-together meetings.
Of leadership.
Leadership meetings. I can never remember the name of that, but it's really good. Last time it was very good. The caucus is going to be out block walking. If you're interested in getting involved with that, you can just show up at noon at their office at 1915 Commonwealth at Welsh. Sunday, they're going to be doing their brunch, their gospel brunch
gospel
at the
brunch.
House of Blues. Mm-hmm. Also, there's a number of other events. Pride is having a coming out
That's
day event.
Right, and Sunday afternoon, the GLBT Community Center, in association with Resurrection MCC, is having an event there at Resurrection Church starting at 2:30.
So all that's happening this week, and I'm sure we're not mentioning everything that's going on. But now, now we have David Elliott calling in from Washington.
David, are you there?
I am here. And who do we have in studio? We have
this
Jennifer,
is
we have Jack.
Jennifer and Jack.
You can't see us?
You can't... Well, you're not on streaming?
I can't see you, but we also have Glenn, right?
Oh, that's right. This is radio. I keep forgetting.
Yes.
Glenn is in the studio, and Brian's helping out in the background.
Okay, so we have Jack, Jennifer, Glenn, and Brian.
Yes, yes.
Okay, it's so unfair. It's so unfair.
Well, I'm the pretty one.
Okay, I will grant you that.
Well, tell us what's going on in Washington.
Well, you know, Jack, tomorrow something
it's Jennifer.
Kind of... Come on, people. Tomorrow, something kind of exciting is going to happen. Okay,
what's going on?
Well, tomorrow, a city council member here, David Cantania, is going to file a bill in city council in Washington, D.C., to legalize same-sex marriage. Now, let's set the
ground rules for this?
The background.
The backstory. Tell us the backstory. Come on.
Backstory. Jennifer, thank you. Right now, four states in the United States recognize same-sex marriage. Those are Connecticut, Iowa, Massachusetts, and Vermont. In addition, come January 1st, 2010, this upcoming January 1st, of course, New Hampshire will join those states. So Washington, D.C. would join five states in recognizing same-sex marriage. Now, this is going to happen. When the bill is filed tomorrow, it's going to be co-sponsored by nine city council members. And there are a total of 13 city council members in D.C.
That's terrific.
So it's definitely going to be passed. Those of you who know that Congress has the right to override laws that D.C. council passes, should know that they probably are not going to override this one.
Really?
Seriously. The Democrats don't want to have anything to do with it. The Republicans are going to try to make it an issue. The Blue Dog Democrats just don't want it to come up. So, within the next month or two, it is a certainty. Let me repeat that. It is a certainty that here where I'm at in Washington, D.C., LGBT couples will be allowed to get married.
Right. We may not be able to get health insurance, but we can get married.
Yeah, that's another thing. We're working on the health insurance.
I know you are.
So that's a really big thing. Now, at the same time, and, you know, in terms of what I'm talking about tonight, Jack and Jennifer, I'm talking about marriage equality, the right of gays, lesbians, transgendered people to get married. So you can see a common theme. So we're going to go now to Maine because there's a really important ballot initiative that we're going to be voting on. Well, not we, but people in Maine in November. What happened in Maine is that last May, the Maine legislature passed a bill approving same-sex marriage, and the governor signed that bill into law. Unfortunately, religious right activists gathered enough signatures to put measure on the ballot. So they needed like 50,000 signatures. So they're going to be voting on same-sex marriage in Maine this November, and it's going to be a really, really close vote. A recent poll that came out showed, 48% would vote to overturn same-sex marriage. That's bad for our side. 46% would vote against it. But the problem is, if you look at sort of the electoral landscape right now, there's a lot of anti-Obama and Democratic Party sentiment out there. And there's also a tax initiative that conservatives are pushing in Maine. So we are really, really, really in deep trouble there. Now, fortunately, LGBT groups across the country are sending right now volunteers into Maine. There are folks that have come from Texas going to Maine. There are folks coming from California, from Illinois. Folks are coming from across the country to Maine to work on canvassing, to work on voter ID. And so that's going to be important. I also just learned today that the Human Rights Campaign donated an additional $50,000 to support the Maine effort. They previously had donated $25,000, so they donated $75,000 in cash. They also have donated another $50,000 in terms of in-kind contributions, which mainly means staff on the ground, boots on the ground, to help the Maine folks with their campaign. It's going to be a really, really close election. I hope that we can pull it out. I don't know if we can. Let's just keep our fingers crossed.
Well, you know, Maine is going to be interesting because it's a rather rural state spread out over a large area. And, you know, Maine only has a population of like 1,300,000?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Something like that.
But how many of them vote? How many of them vote?
Well, and, you know, it's an off-year election, so probably not very many. But, you know, Maine also has a don't-tread-on-me political culture. You know, and, you know, one really great thing that I saw is that the campaign in favor of same-sex marriage, it's called Stand for Marriage Maine. Take that back. Take that back. That's Stand for Marriage Maine is the other side's campaign. I'm trying to find in my notes what the name of our campaign is, and I can't find it. But we just started airing a commercial showing blue-collar workers, like a firefighter and a couple of farmers, who are saying, hey, we want people to live free as they want to, and we don't want to interfere with anyone's personal decisions.
That's a good way of putting it.
Mm-hmm. So I also wanted to talk about, if I could, what's going on in California.
Well, before we go there, I sent you that article about what's happening in Dallas. Did you see that?
I saw that, and I'm just sort of wondering, you know, like,
is that good or bad?
Well, it's great, but my question is, where does it get overturned first? And Jack, do you want to what you're talking about?
Yes, basically, there is two guys who married. I don't remember what state they married in, but they moved back to. They either live in Texas or moved back to Texas, and now they want to get a divorce. And basically, the Republicans are saying there's no way you can give them a divorce because marriage is not legal, and gay marriage is not legal in Texas. But the court looks like they want to take this case up, so we're going to see where that takes us.
And, Jack, do I detect an overwhelming irony in this?
Yes, yes.
They're telling us that they don't want us to get married. But once we're married, we have no power, according to them, to get a divorce.
Exactly.
Hmm.
They can't have it both ways.
Well, I guess maybe they're protecting marriage.
That's right. Well, then they need to protect it from heterosexual divorce. So,
amazing.
Yes.
Okay, let's go to California.
Let's go to California. Yeah. So I want to hear about the health initiative sometime.
Well, let's go to California, and then we'll get to that.
Okay.
Equality California... very strong group. They're fighting not just in California, but nationwide for LGBT marriage. They just sent another $25,000 to Maine, by the way. It looks like they are going to wait until 2012 to push a ballot initiative that will restore same-sex marriage in the state. Now, there are some LGBT activists who want them to push for it in 2010. One of them, for example, is Steve Hildebrand, who was a very high-ranking, in fact, the highest-ranking gay official in President Obama's campaign last year. He sent a letter where he urged people to really fight to get this on the initiative next year in 2010. He said, quote, "I feel strongly that 2010 is the right time to courageously win back marriage rights in California, as strongly as I felt when I decided to devote 2 years of my life to help Barack Obama run for president, despite warnings from the pundits and pollsters that he would never occupy the Oval Office." Now, I respect Steve Hildebrand, and there are some other folks who agree with him that it should be on the ballot next year. But the fact is, the demographics, the electoral demographics, will more guarantee us, if that's even the right word, a victory in 2012 than they will in 2010. In 2010, we are more likely to see a conservative get-out-the-vote effort. We're more likely to see a depressed voter turnout. And I don't see winning, even in California, on the ballot. And I think we can win in 2012. We'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Exactly. Now, on to health care.
Yes, tell us about that.
One month ago, people, the debate was whether or not we were going to have a public option, a public health insurance option, or not have one at all. Today, the debate has fundamentally shifted. We are no longer debating whether we are going to have a public option or no public option. Rather, we are debating what the public option is going to look like. People, we are looking at real healthcare reform.
Really?
Yes. We're going to have a bill come out of Senate Finance Committee tomorrow. It is not going to be a good bill. In fact, of the five bills that are out there, it's going to be the worst. But it's also going to be what we call the floor, the very worst option that we can build off of. It looks like this bill is going to be merged with another better Senate bill. The Obama administration has now started, finally, within the last few days, negotiating behind the scenes to push for a public health insurance option. We're going to have a great bill come out of the House. We are looking at votes on both the Senate floor and the House floor at the very end of this month, which means that in November we'll go to conference committee, and then sometime maybe around Thanksgiving, maybe not till December, it just seems to go on and on and on, folks, we will pass a final health care reform bill, and it will go to the president's desk for his signature. Now, this is not going to be a wonderful health care reform bill. It's not going to be the be-all, end-all. But I want to share an anecdote with you, if I may. Way back in the early 1930s, President Roosevelt was pushing a bill to establish the Social Security Act. Today, that piece of legislation is seen as the most progressive legislation ever passed in the 20th century. But consider that when that bill first passed, it excluded domestic workers, which meant it excluded most African American workers. It excluded agricultural workers, which meant it excluded most Latino workers,
right,
and a lot of African-American workers. It excluded school teachers. It excluded government employees. All of that meant that it excluded a lot of women, a lot of people of Jewish faith, and that was done intentionally. And all of this was done so that President Roosevelt could get the votes of Southern Democrats. But what happened is they established a foundation for the concept that we in our country should protect and defend and take care of our elderly citizens, our parents, our grandparents. And they built on that every 2 years. Every time Congress would come back, they built on it and they built on it and they built on it. What we are going to do this year is introduce legislatively the concept that every American should have access to affordable, quality health care. It's not going to be as good, probably, as we want it to be this first time out, but we're going to develop a foundation that we can build on and build on and build on. I hope it's going to be good. I think it's probably going to be somewhere around a B minus, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Bush gave us an F. And we have people dying every single day because they don't have health insurance. And even if the worst case scenario, the worst bill passes that can pass, you know what? We're going to cover just about everybody. We're going to cover 38 million new Americans. We're going to stop the insurance industry from kicking people off because of pre-existing conditions. We're going to stop the insurance industry from, you know, coming out and saying, oh, well, yeah, you have insurance. You paid your premium. But, you know, you have this condition now, so we're not going to cover you anymore. We're going to stop all that. We're going to fight for the best bill we can get. I think we're going to get a good bill. We'll see how good it is.
Well, now, but you're awfully optimistic on this, David, and I hope you're right.
I at the end of the day, I'm going to be right. We're going to pass really good health care reform. Well, we're going to pass pretty good health care reform. There are some things I'm worried about. You know, all of a sudden, we're going to be mandating every American to buy health insurance. And we're going to have to make sure that it's affordable.
Right.
For low-income people, it's not going to be a problem because they're going to get tax credits. But there's this bubble that exists between people who make too much money to be able to afford Medicaid, but they're not going to be able to make. They're not going to be in a place where they can get tax credits and premiums and subsidies, and it's going to be a problem. So we're really going to have to look at that.
Well, I have a question, and that is part of this bill, this is something I haven't heard talked about, is part of this bill going to remove the health insurance exemption from the antitrust legislation? Because currently the health insurance community is exempt from antitrust.
Well, you know, Jennifer, it's really interesting. There are two major businesses that are exempt from legislation in this country. You've identified one of them, which is health care. Can you identify the other?
It's the baseball. Baseball is exempt. Yes.
You got it. Yeah. Major League Baseball.
Major League Baseball is exempt too.
And health insurance are the only two major businesses exempt from federal antitrust laws. And Jennifer,
although I think the phone companies are too, but that's my opinion.
we could argue that. But yeah, I'm from a consumer perspective, Jack, I'm with you. Jennifer, the answer to your question is sadly no.
Because part of any control of insurance costs, I'm talking about increases, you know, needs to be where you can, in fact, shop the market for regular insurance, no matter what state you're in. But as long as they're exempt from antitrust, they just cut up the country in bits and pieces.
Well, I will say two things. First of all, if we have a robust public health insurance option, then conceivably every consumer would get to shop around. And then the other thing is, and I don't want to get too much into the weeds here, but all of the health insurance plans, all of the five bills that are under consideration in Congress would create what's called an exchange. Like right now, for instance, I don't have any choice when it comes to purchasing health insurance. I buy it through my employer.
And you're lucky to be able to do that.
And you're lucky to even have insurance.
I am very lucky. And in most states, you have one insurer, often it's Blue Cross Blue Shield, controlling a majority of the market, and then maybe you have two other insurers, with a smaller piece of the market.
Right.
Now, what we're considering now is that in every state, consumers would be able to go to something called an exchange, and there would be five or six insurers where they could purchase policies from. However, there's no guarantee that there's no antitrust law here. There's no guarantee that these companies offering policies in all these different states couldn't, like, meet somewhere, behind closed doors and do a nudge-nudge, wink-wink thing and, sort of reach an agreement on their prices so that when you go to the exchange and you're supposed to have a choice, actually it's no choice at all. They're all charging the same premiums, and they're all screwing us.
Yes, basically. Which is exactly what it is. It's like a cabal. They are able to set rates. They watch each other. Now, that's good business, but when you are protected by the cloak of exemption from antitrust, you can, in fact, meet at lunch and decide what prices you're going to charge, whether they're warranted or not.
Well, exactly. Exactly, and that's as the bills come together and are merged together, and as the Senate bill reaches the floor, and then as the House, which has a much, much better bill, as the House bill passes, and then as we go to conference and work these things out, this is something to keep an eye on.
Okay.
It's a major concern. I mean, the concerns are, A, affordability, B, mandating employers to offer insurance to their employees, C, having a public option, D, inclusivity. And when I say inclusivity, I mean that immigrants should be covered and health insurance should cover reproductive health care. Those are, those are some of the main things that we're looking at.
To move on a little bit, I would like to know where we stand on the Employment Non-Discrimination Act.
Jennifer, I don't know that that's going to move this year. It should, and we talked about that a month or 2 months ago, but Congress is looking at health care reform. They're looking at financial regulation. Now it looks like they're going to be looking at dealing with the estate tax. Originally, they were supposed to adjourn in late October. Now it looks like they might be adjourning on December 21st. They completely skipped over the month of November. I don't want to say that the LGBT community is being thrown under the bus, because let's face it, the LGBT community is affected by health care, is affected by immigration, is affected by financial reform. LGBT people have retirement funds just like anybody else. But I will say that the issue of ENDA, I think, might get pushed back into next year.
Well, great, David. And one last thing is Michael Moore's new movie. It's I don't know if you've seen it. It's fabulous.
I haven't seen it yet, but I saw that it's number 5 already on the top 10 movies list.
Good. Maybe he can donate some of that cash to help pay the taxpayers back.
Yeah.
Yes. David, tell us what your day job is.
Well, I'm communications director for U.S. Action and TrueMajority.org. And you can find us at usaction.org, truemajority.org. We are fighting tooth and nail to get quality, affordable health care for all with a robust public health insurance option.
Well, and we appreciate all the work you do, both here on the show and what you're doing professionally, because that is so important. David joins us the first Monday of every month to give us sort of a national perspective of what's going on in our community and the progressive community in general. Thank you, David.
Well, thank you, Jack and Jennifer, and, you know, hello to everybody out listening to Queer Voices.
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 3rd, 2009. The newly installed president of the United Nations General Assembly, Ali Abdesalam Traki, has called homosexuality not really acceptable. Traki, who is the Libyan Secretary of African Union Affairs, held a press conference late last week as he convened the 64th session of the General Assembly. He was asked about a UN resolution passed by the General Assembly last December calling for the universal decriminalization of homosexuality. "That matter is very sensitive, very touchy," he said. "As a Muslim, I am not in favor of it. I think it's not really acceptable by our religion, our tradition. There are some countries that allow that, thinking it is a kind of democracy," he added. "I think it is not." A large coalition of predominantly Muslim countries strongly opposed the UN resolution. The International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission condemned Traki's remarks, saying that the worrying and serious implications of this attitude coming from the new head of an institution which is supposed to regard human rights, all human rights, as the most sacred value, cannot be overstated. Openly gay British member of the European Parliament, Michael Cashman, this week called Traki's comments inappropriate and unacceptable. His religious beliefs must remain private. He must realize that the implications of his words could legitimize violence toward LGBT people. Openly gay U.S. Congressman Barney Frank told the LGBT On Top website that this is par for the course for a Libyan official: offensive, stupid, and bigoted.
Guido Westerwelle, who spent 8 years leading Germany's pro-business Free Democratic Party, may very well soon be the country's first openly gay foreign minister. His party is expected to be part of the coalition government of newly re-elected conservative chancellor Angela Merkel. Westerwelle doesn't consider himself to be a gay activist, but he said that his success may be encouraging for some young gays. "I can only tell all young gays and lesbians to not be disheartened if not everything goes their way," Westerwelle told the Berlin-based gay magazine. "This society is changing for the good in the direction of tolerance and respect, though slower than I would wish." Westerwelle basically came out in 2004 when he brought his male partner to Merkel's 50th birthday party. Klaus Jetz of Germany's Lesbian and Gay Association said he expects Westerwelle to push for greater LGBT equality in the new government and told reporters that it's important that as foreign minister he will openly talk about human rights and the persecution of gays and lesbians in other countries.
Same-gender couples in Portugal are waiting to see whether their re-elected prime minister will deliver on his promise to enact marriage equality. José Sócrates and his Socialist Party government were returned to power last week. They don't have a parliamentary majority, but left-wing parties hold a majority of the seats, and they've all supported marriage rights for lesbian and gay couples. But marriage equality remains an uphill climb in Portugal, which has a large Roman Catholic population. The church strongly opposes the legal recognition of same-gender couples.
El Salvador's Roman Catholic Church joined right-wing parties last week in support of constitutional amendments to ban same-gender couples from legally marrying or adopting children. But the governing left-wing Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front opposed the moves, and the bills failed in Congress. Amending the Constitution in El Salvador requires approval in one legislative session and ratification by at least a two-thirds majority in the next parliamentary session. President Mauricio Funes has said that the proposed amendments would violate the civil rights of LGBT people. But the proposed constitutional changes were sent back for review by a commission. They can still be reintroduced at a later time during the current legislative session.
The Vatican itself took another shot at gay men this week in its relentless attacks on sexual minorities. A statement read by Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Vatican's permanent observer to the United Nations, claimed that the vast majority of child sexual abuse in the Catholic Church was committed by homosexuals, not pedophiles. Of all priests involved in the abuses, Tomasi said, 80 to 90% belong to this sexual orientation minority, which is sexually engaged with adolescent boys between the ages of 11 and 17. He said that it would be more correct to refer to ephebophilia, a homosexual attraction to adolescent males, than pedophilia. The statement followed a meeting of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva and charges by the International Humanist and Ethical Union that the Vatican is continuing to cover up child sex abuse cases.
Elsewhere, same-gender couples in the Australian island state of Tasmania will soon be able to have marriage celebrants preside at their civil union ceremonies. Couples have been able to register their relationships since 2003 by signing a deed at their registry of births, deaths, and marriages. But the administrative change to take effect on November 1st will also allow a more formal registration of the relationship. Rodney Croom of the Tasmanian Gay and Lesbian Rights Group said he expects to see a rise in registrations because it's been important to many couples to be able to celebrate their unions in official ceremonies witnessed by family and friends. Attorney General Laura Giddings told reporters that in the past what they did was turn up to the registry office as you do to register your dog, you would turn up to register your relationship. Now, quite rightly, she added, people felt that that did not give their relationship the dignity they wanted it to have.
And in the U.S., Nevada's domestic partnership law, which grants many of the legal rights of marriage to cohabiting same-gender and heterosexual couples, went into effect on October 1st. The first couple to be issued a certificate, Lee Cagley and Larry Davis, shared tears and laughter as they were congratulated by Secretary of State Ross Miller. While Nevada's constitution bans same-gender marriage, the domestic partnership law extends rights similar to those held by married couples, including community property and the right to seek financial support after breakup to cohabiting couples. It allows but doesn't require employers to extend insurance benefits to domestic partners. The measure was vetoed by Governor Jim Gibbons, but overridden by the legislature in May. About 750 couples had applied as of midday on October 1st. Nevada joined 16 other states that have laws recognizing some form of same-gender domestic partnerships. Voters in Washington will be asked to uphold that state's everything-but-marriage domestic partnerships law on November 3rd, while Maine voters will be asked to repeal the state's marriage equality law. And voters in Kalamazoo, Michigan, will be considering a ballot measure to repeal the city's law protecting LGBT people from discrimination.
An unlikely battle over marriage rights and divorce began in Texas this week. State District Judge Tina Callahan ruled in Dallas that two men who've been together for 11 years and married in Massachusetts in 2006 could be divorced in the Lone Star State, even though its voters overwhelmingly approved a constitutional ban on same-gender marriage in 2005. She declared that the ban violates equal protection provisions of the Texas and U.S. constitutions and that her court has jurisdiction to hear a suit for divorce filed by persons legally married in another jurisdiction. The men in the case are asking not to be identified because one of them is not out to his employer. Attorney General Greg Abbott said he would vigorously appeal the ruling to defend the traditional definition of marriage that was approved by Texas voters. But Dallas attorney Peter Schulte, who represents one of the men, argued that if a divorce is granted in the case, the court is not creating, recognizing, or validating a marriage between persons of the same sex. Rather, the effect of a divorce immediately ends a marriage, which furthers the public policy of this state as written in the Family Code.
And finally, the children's book, And Tango Makes Three, about a real-life male penguin couple in New York's Central Park Zoo who incubate a rejected egg and raise the resulting baby chick, has for the third straight year topped the American Library Association's list of most banned books. Opponents who've wanted the book removed from public library shelves complained about its homosexual content and called it anti-ethnic, anti-family, and unsuited to the age group. And Tango Makes Three is also scheduled to be published in Poland. But right-wing politicians have reportedly called for a ban there. MEP Tadeusz Szymański of the Law and Justice Party said the book promotes homosexuality. But in what the New York Times reported this week as yet another example of life imitating art, or at least humans imitating animals, the authors of And Tango Makes Three, Justin Richardson and Peter Parnell, are raising their own baby. The gay couple, who live in New York City's West Village, welcomed their first child in February. Gemma Parnell Richardson was born to a surrogate mother. The egg was fertilized by sperm from one of the men, though which one was left to chance. The two penguins, Roy and Silo, had been an identifiable couple for 6 years when they tried to hatch a rock in their nest. A sympathetic zookeeper gave them a fertile egg from another penguin couple that had problems tending to two eggs. Roy and Silo sat on the egg, which hatched, and the baby penguin was named Tango since it takes two. Richardson told the Times that, "We tried to incubate a rock, and that didn't work."
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 3rd, 2009. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. You can read the text of this week's News Wrap online at www.thiswayout.org. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
This is Queer Voices.
This is Brian Levinka.
And Jennifer Renee.
And tonight we have a political guest.
Very special. You give the disclaimer.
Okay. We have to, as a station, disclaim that we do not endorse candidates. But tonight we have Councilmember Sue Lowell, Level.
And who has been an outstanding representative for the city and the two terms, and this is, you're running for your third term.
Third term,
yes,
can't believe it.
Third time's a charm.
Goes by quickly.
It does. And you've been very busy in the last 4 years or 3.5 years. And before then, you've been in the city for how long now? How long have you lived here in
Houston? I moved here in 1970. And became politically active in about 1979, 1980 in the community. So I've been busy for a long time.
So you've seen it from the beginning, like all the crazy stuff that's happened in the 70s and 80s.
It was. There was some good things that happened, like, you know, Eleanor Tinsley getting elected, the first candidate that was endorsed by what was then the Gay Political Caucus.
Mm-hmm.
And she won. That was a big, that's what really gave the caucus its start. And that was a huge victory. And then through the caucus growing and endorsing candidates and Kathy Whitmire being elected, passing a non-discrimination ordinance and not having the good sense to prepare for a referendum and getting our butts kicked pretty good. And then recovering from that and now having by executive order non-discrimination.
What year was that when the ordinance? Was that 85?
85 is when we were beat. Right.
85. Has the city changed enough? Is it time again, or is it, what's that, 20 years?
24.
24 years?
Well, we have an executive order. The city's changed tremendously.
That's the point.
Yeah, I mean, the city has grown. It's so diverse. You can look on city council right now. I say council works really well because at least half the council is women. In my first term, the majority were women, and it worked very well. Bill White, you know, seems to like the makeup of that. He's appointed a lot of women to chair a lot of the committees. I chair transportation, infrastructure, quality of life, and then also the Historic Preservation Committee. But our council is very diverse. It reflects what the city is now, and the city is very diverse.
Because I remember early on when I came to Houston in 1980, you know, it was an entirely different makeup. And, of course, we were still single-member, not district, single-member. We had the five at-large districts. And it took a negotiation with the federal government, and we broke down into districts.
Broke down into districts. In fact, the next year after the census, we'll add two more council districts. But the wisdom in having at-large, which I'm at-large position too, has really worked well for the city. If everybody represents a district, then you only represent your part of the city.
Right.
That's not good for the overall decision-making on behalf of the city. The at-large members, such as myself, well, we represent all the city. And that helps in some of the decision-making and things that we do, that you have people that are looking out for all of the city, not just a certain portion of the city.
Most cities don't have that combination of at-large and districts, and it seems to work real well for Houston.
It's proven itself to work very well.
And it's important because you have a mayor who's elected citywide.
Yep.
And then you have five council members who are elected citywide. So there's six people looking out for the city as a whole,
mm-hmm.
and then individual districts.
About half and half. Half the council's looking out for the whole city, and the other half are looking out for their districts, and it works out very well.
It sure does. Now, with these next two, will it be just based on census, or does anybody have any idea how that's going to be broken down?
Well, we have enough to add two more districts.
But where will they be?
Well, that'll be done. Actually, it's done by computers now with the new technology.
And the maps are going to redraw all the districts and everything?
They will. They'll be smaller, and then they'll add two more districts, which is good. I mean, the districts are pretty large now in population.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as the inner city especially has become more dense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot for district council members. It's a lot of work. So we'll add two more districts, and don't know where they'll be, probably somewhere southwest, out west, that'll be there, and so that'll be exciting. We'll have
will they separate Kingwood and Clear Lake? You know, we've got that one crazy district where they're separated by a lot of miles.
We call it the Lakes District. I don't know. All that is based on the Voting Rights Act, and you know, there's certain, you know, rules you cannot violate. They have to be balanced. So the difficult part of that is if you take Kingwood out, then it would go to District B. Kingwood is so big it would actually probably overtake what is now a African American district, and according to the Voting Rights Act, that can't happen. So we'll leave that up to the computers and the people that do the maps, and hopefully I'll be there on council voting. I think the exciting thing that may happen is, you know, originally Montrose was in District C, and then over 12 years ago we got moved into D. I think probably this time we'll be put back into District C, which for Montrose, the significance is that we can elect a district council member again. Anybody that's been elected, Anissa, myself, we've had to be elected citywide because of the makeup of the district. So that'll be exciting to maybe.
What is District C? Is that like west, southwest?
It's southwest. If you go on the other side of Shepherd, and it runs Kirby, and then down through the Bel Air, Brazewood, out that way.
And District D is more like Fourth Ward and kind of over to Sunnyside, I guess.
It's Montrose and then south, down Third Ward through Sunnyside, down that way.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things is, which is a question you would have never imagined when you got active in 1979, that we would have a number of openly gay people running for office.
We do. It's very exciting. I mean, you know, we have Anise running for mayor, myself running for re-election, but we have in some other races, we have Lane Lewis running in District A, who actually is a former president of the caucus, has been a teacher and worked very hard in his neighborhood. And then we have Mike Lassiter in District F, who had run before and about 12 years ago and lost, but he's been president of the Sharpstown Association. He's the president of the Management District and the TERS out there. And then you have Noel Freeman, who's running citywide in position 4, who ran before in that special election with Melissa Noriega and did well. You know, everybody's gone and done their work in their neighborhoods and civic associations and in parts of the city, and now they've decided they want to go to the council table. It's very exciting.
It really is. And for those of you who are just joining us, we're talking with Councilmember Sue Lovell, and we're talking
who's
about
also the vice mayor pro tem.
Add that title.
The
mayor's been busy these days, so I've been
his next race.
Yes,
he's been busy. Yeah. I've been doing proclamations. Did a national night out today with Chief Hurt. On Wednesday, the mayor will be gone, so I get to preside over a council meeting again, which is great fun. It's a very humbling experience to sit in that chair.
Do you get to put people in line and say, shut up and be quiet?
Well, I try, but, you know, public session, we have a cast of characters that usually come, but it's their right. to come, and actually it's quite interesting and entertaining.
And speaking, yes, I know, Ray Hill always loves
Ray
to come
Hill
join y'all.
Yeah, he makes his annual trek down there.
Is it just annual? I don't think it's annual, is it?
He doesn't come as often as he used to. Maybe, you know, maybe he thinks we're doing a good job. But
well, let's hope so. I think so.
I think we're doing an excellent job. This city is the place to be in the United States right now.
I agree.
It is.
Now, I was going to ask, how did you get started in politics? What kind of brought you into this?
Well, I was raised in California in the 60s, so I was, you know, doing some of those anti-war demonstrations and sneaking off to Berkeley. And then when I moved here in 1970... pretty much was playing softball and enjoying the big city and having a good time. And I owned a printing business, and a friend of mine was a member of the caucus and asked me if I would volunteer and do a newsletter for the caucus. And I said, yeah, I'll volunteer and donate the newsletter. And I had to bring it by one evening to a meeting. And there was a young man standing at the front of the room who was black and blue because he had been beat up in Montrose simply because he was gay.
Wow.
And when he told his story, there was something in me that said, you know, this is not right. So it became from just printing free newsletters to running for the board and becoming active, and that's really how I got my start. You know, and the days of playing softball and then running around having a good time, they were gone. But I'll tell you what, it's been an incredible experience. Every skill set that I use at City Hall, and somehow or another, I come back to our community. You know, I was a founding board member of the AIDS Foundation, and that was a real learning experience.
Wasn't your family touched by AIDS?
I lost my baby brother in 1988, so and a lot of friends. So all the skills that I get to use at City Council, a lot of them came from this community and the leadership that I learned from being a part of this community. So I owe a lot to this community.
Well, let's go back to the city. With the economic situation the way it is, what can we look at? What's going to happen with the city over the next year or two?
Well, next year we're going to need good leadership, and I know who I'm going to vote for, the person that has the most experience, and my good friend, Anise Parker. Simply because the economic downturn is going to catch up with us here. We're not going to feel it like other cities, but there's going to be difficult decisions we're going to have to make on the budget and other decision making about things that we may have to cut back on. So it's going to be a difficult year. We're going to need some good council members there to make some decisions. We're going to have to make a decision about what we're going to do about our infrastructure, which is and drainage and flooding. And those are going to be some difficult decisions. And then we have exciting decisions. Like, I just came back from Washington. I represent the city on the Transportation Policy Commission. And we went up there to start asking for federal dollars to put in commuter rail. Who would have ever thought?
Who would have thought
commuter rail that goes out in Houston?
Houston? What is that?
Goes north out Hempstead Highway. Waller is involved all the way out there. And then down Highway 3 all the way to Galveston. And then also how we can adjust some of our freight rail tracks so that we're not dragging the freight through the city every day, blocking up intersections. And it would improve our traffic situation incredibly. But commuter rail is very exciting. It's going to happen. And probably some point we'll have the bullet train that will come into Houston and connect to Dallas, to Austin.
I know they've been talking about that for years, and I think Southwest Airlines shut it down.
They did, but now, you know, you have to go to the airport an hour. It isn't like the old days where, you know, you just dove onto the plane, got in your seat, and you were in Dallas in an hour.
Ever since 9/11, it takes a little longer.
It takes a lot longer.
I mean, even though it's fairly quick, it's still...
Got to take off your shoes, got to take off your belt buckle.
I know, it's like you want to go in flip-flops and scrubs to the airport.
And then,
you know, we have three of the light rail lines that are being built, and soon the fourth, the university line, will start. So there's exciting things happening in the city that nobody ever thought. So next year is going to be some tough decisions, but also some new exciting adventures for us here in the city.
When do we anticipate seeing the light rail start being, the construction actually starting?
They've already started on Harrisburg.
Okay.
They've already started there, and they've already started on the North Line route. The other southeast line that'll run along Scott and go south towards the Palm Center, they've started on some of that. The university line probably be maybe next year. We still have to get some final approval and some funding on that. So those projects will start pretty shortly.
And I've had this question posed to me, and I have no answer for it. So I'm going to use my chance. On light rail, why don't they ever, it's always at grade, which means that intersections are blocked at times with the, why didn't we put it up in the air or below ground? Below ground, it'd become a swimming pool, but why wouldn't we put it up in the air? Why didn't we?
Because the cost is a lot more. I mean, it's a lot more to put it up above.
It was a struggle to get light rail in the first place.
So right.
Had to kind of,
actually, yeah. When I moved here in 1970, the voters voted down putting in a monorail system. And which, you know, in hindsight, that had been incredible.
Yeah.
So it's at grade just because of the cost. And, you know, there's other cities that you know, if you go to San Francisco, the cable cars run right alongside the cars. They're not even in a designated lane.
Right.
So there's other cities where it's a grade separation and that adds the cost. It makes it double what it is. And going underground makes it even more expensive. Like on Harrisburg, they want to do an underpass.
Right.
Problem is, there's brownfields over there from those old industries. So you start disturbing that dirt over there, you've got millions and millions of dollars of remediation, much less add, you know, more and more years to wait. So, you know, we want to get the rails down, get the light rail running, so we can connect up our employment centers in the city and get some of the cars off the street.
We can't keep building freeways. Like, I-10 is, I call it the world's longest linear parking lot, because it's crazy. It's 20 lanes that go on forever.
It is, but I'll tell you, if you've been to Austin lately, I took a trip up there. Really, our traffic is nothing compared to what goes on 35 up there.
Yeah. Well, that's, they have less options, but...
If there's anything that we haven't asked that you'd like to address, what would it be?
I think, you know, we have an important election coming up, and there seems not to be a lot of enthusiasm in the city. I know the viewers that listeners that dial in here. I'm glad you're viewing. The great thing about radio is you don't have to really look great to be on the radio.
We're all tens on the radio. Yeah. We're all tens on the radio.
For your 10 in real life.
Oh.
But I know the listeners, they take elections seriously. So I know the listeners here know about the election, know it's on November 3rd, know the importance of going and voting, because, you know, we need to keep good counsel, good leadership, keep the city moving the way it's going. So I would say, you know, talk it up. It's an important election. Make sure that your friends, your family, your neighbors, people at your church know there's an election coming up, and encourage them to pick up the caucus endorsement card and go vote, because we have one of the best endorsement processes, one of the oldest, but one of the best, the fairest in the whole city.
Well, thank you. We've been talking with Sue Lovell, city council member.
And Mayor Pro Tem.
You reminded me. I was about to say that.
Forget.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
This is Queer Voices.
In keeping with KPFT's mission of bringing the voices of the community to you, here is one of your candidates in the upcoming election for local station board.
Hello, I'm Michael Young, and I'm running for the local station board. I've been a dedicated public servant for the last 3 or 4 years, working highly in the nonprofit field. I currently work for the Houston Museum District, as well as working for many nonprofits in the past. I've been involved in many local and national political campaigns, been involved with the Barack Obama campaign, as well as Acorn. I believe this experience could help bring valuable insight to the local station board.
That was a statement by Michael Young. For complete candidate statements and more information about all of your candidates for the local station board, please visit kpft.org. The future of KPFT and the entire Pacifica network now rests upon the participation of our listener members. It depends upon your vote. Participate in democracy in action and support KPFT Radio for Peace. This is KPFT Houston.
Listeners support KPFT in many different ways. Some write checks and others use credit cards. But if you're spinning your wheels looking for a tax deduction, think about donating your working but unwanted car, motorcycle, boat, or truck to KPFT. You'll qualify for a tax deduction and at the same time take care of that unfinished business. To make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. We'll arrange for your vehicle to be picked up and the title transferred. Then we'll send you a receipt for your tax deduction. It's that simple to support the station you've come to rely on for alternative music, news, and public affairs programming. Again, for more information or to make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. You're tuned in to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston, radio for people.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
This is J.D. Doyle with a special Queer Voices feature. The National Equality March is Sunday, October 11th in Washington, D.C., and after the march is a rally with various speakers. The organizers sponsored an equality song contest with online voting, and I'm pleased that one of my artist friends won it and will be performing the song at the rally. She's Julie Clark and lives in Norfolk, Virginia. And you can find out more about her at www.julieclark.net. I interviewed her this year and, of course, asked her about the song that went on to win the competition. It's from her album, Change Your Mind, and I'd like to share with you her comments about the song and then let you hear it. Julie Clark and Courage of Our Convictions.
Courage of Our Convictions is a song that has kind of a life and meaning of its own that's very special to me. You know, I have like one foot in the gay and lesbian music world and the other very squarely in the mainstream modern folk world. And so for me to put a gay rights song on a CD, I'll confess that it takes a bit of courage, you know, to put that on there. It's like other artists are quite militant and they would never, it doesn't take courage, you know, not at all. But for me, I guess it does, you know, it does take a bit of courage to put that out there and to be so openly, you know, just so openly gay, even in the mainstream music world that I'm singing about equal rights. But, you know, I'm glad to say that I'm up for it.
Dear brothers and sisters too, working to make a change, long overdue.
Well, well, well.
We're gonna fight for freedom. Yeah, yeah, we're gonna fight for love. We're gonna fight 'cause nothing less than equal's good enough. It's gonna take our time. Friends, we're gonna need a much higher power than
gotta show them kindness. Gotta show them love. We gotta show them there's nothing here to be scared of.
No, no, no.
Our civil rights can't be denied. Cause we got God and justice.
This is Brian Levinka.
And Jennifer Renee, and we have in our studio tonight Reverend Ernie Turney.
The minister,
yes, of Bering Memorial Methodist Church with us tonight in the continuing series on faith and the GLBT community here in Houston. And for those of you who don't know that Bering Memorial Methodist is a reconciling congregation.
What does that mean?
And
that means everyone is welcome. Everybody can come and everybody can participate, and all means all.
Yeah. Well, Bering, not necessarily in that name, has been in Houston since 1848.
Yes.
And then became Bering in 1911 by name, a memorial after two of the original founders of the church here in Houston. And then in 26, at its new location, it was the new location there at Herald and, was it Commonwealth?
Mulberry.
Well, one of the things is it's in the heart of our community here in the Montrose and has been serving our community for a long time. Tell us, what brought you, how long have you been here at Memorial, and where'd you come from before then?
I've been here just a little over a year. I moved the week before Ike came. September 1st.
You got here just in time.
You brought the hurricane with you.
Did you lose power?
For 3.5 weeks.
Ah.
Yes. So, yes, the hurricane brought me, and we've been fighting it ever since. Yeah. We had lots of damage and lots of things going on.
Where did you come from?
I was in Kilgore in East Texas.
Kilgore.
Oh, gosh.
Yes.
That's Kilgore, where my family hails from up there, Kilgore.
Is that the
Tatum? And
the Rangerettes are from Kilgore?
Rangerettes are in Kilgore, and Tyler Junior College is where the Apache Bells are, so yes. Good old East Texas.
Oh, yes. Deep East Texas.
How do you like Houston?
Lived here before.
Oh, okay.
In 2000, came here and served Ashford on the west side of town, and was there for 6 years. And so that was my first introduction to the big city. Other than that, I've been in county seat towns and other places like that. So it was fun. And enjoying the city again, and enjoying the 77006 zip code. As they say, there is not another one like it in Houston.
Absolutely.
So we are thrilled to be here.
Tell me some of the activities there at Bering as it relates to the GLBT community.
Most of what we do is related to the GLBT community.
I was giving you a softball right there.
Sure, easy. Thank you. Bering has always been a church that responded to whatever was the health crisis, and part of that has always shaped and formed the identity of this church. And when the yellow fever epidemic happened, it was people from Bering determined that they would bring in the yellow fever victims when everybody else was locking their doors and keeping people out in a way. Bering was one of those churches that said, nope. It's okay. We're gonna do what needs to be done.
That was in 1859.
In the 1850s, early on.
You are full of your historical facts today.
Yes,
I did some research. I did.
So then, it's always been. And when the AIDS crisis came, it was just not much of the DNA of who we are was already there in this church, and so there was just I won't say there was no controversy, because there was some, as always. You know, you have to redefine yourself at all points. But it did become part of the definition of who Baring was and how the church was going to respond. And Don Sinclair was the minister that started some of the ministries in the 80s that was... are still going on to this day, and that includes the dental clinic at Baring Omega. Mm-hmm. And
I mean, that's a Baring Omega.
Is that part of the church, or is that
it's all started as part of the church, but in order for us to receive government funds, they have been transferred to their own 501c3, but okay. We still have some board members that sit on those. And
it sits on the grounds of
the church. On the grounds. We see a third of the dental patients, HIV dental patients, for the city of Houston.
Wow. And I know that you, not only do you have outreach to the GLBT community and other, in like Baring Omega and all, but you the church is used by a lot of other organizations around in our community there.
The people that are coming, a Sisters meets there, and Gay Fathers of Houston meet there, and many other groups on regular and irregular basis use us for a community place. And the other piece of that in our outreach is our Baring support network, which is things that we do in the church. We have a counseling center, we have HIV support groups, individual counseling, and one of the programs that Don Sinclair began was the Wednesday night covered dish program, because this was in the days of the 80s when we were all afraid that AIDS could be transferred by mosquito bites or by eating food that had been touched by somebody.
Right.
And so they demythologized that by having a covered dish meal, and that still goes on, and we are averaging usually about 60 folks on a Wednesday night that come, and then we have a support group meeting that follows the covered dish meal.
Real quickly, let's give them the address so they'll know where the church is. We told them, if they don't know where the cross streets are, it's on Harold.
It's 1440 Harold. It's
And services are held on?
Sunday morning.
At what time?
Our main service is at 10:50. We have a small communion service at 8:30 for a few early birds, but our main service with our organ and full music program and all that is at 10:50.
Okay. Any other services? You know how there's some of them on Saturdays and Wednesdays. And
We have Bible studies and spiritual support and formation groups and other things during the week, but those things change by semester almost, depending on people's schedule and who's teaching what. So, yeah.
Where does the church stand, the Methodist Church stand, and of course, your direct opinion concerning gay marriage?
Oh, good.
Excuse me, marriage equality.
Okay. The Methodist Church at this point is lagging behind the Lutherans and the Episcopalians and the other Protestant denominations. And that's, for me and for many of my friends that are in ministry, that's a very sad thing. But that's kind of where we are right now in the conservative state of Texas in the South and other things like that. I think I've had a lot of learning curves since I got here. You have to understand, social justice was one of my causes. I have no family member close that was a GLBT person or anything like that. And so I didn't know any of the initials or anything. So in the last 12 months, I have had to learn a lot of different things. And I probably came here with an understanding of civil union being okay. But I would tell you that in the last few months that I have come to really, really understand that marriage is really the only option for equality for all people. And if we're going to say everything's open to all, but at this point in time in the United Methodist Church, I cannot perform unions. Even if Texas passed the law, that the Methodist Church would not allow me to do weddings as I understand it.
You know, I think that the hang-up is the whole church thing. I mean, from my perspective, I would rather have the rites, you know, and the legal aspects. You know, I don't have to have a ceremony in a church. I just want the same equal rights.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of where our movement is kind of stalling out. And change is difficult, and you know.
And change is tediously slow.
Right.
And it takes a lot of different conversions for a lot of different folks until we can all get to a place, and we're just not there yet.
And I'm sure Texas will be at the bottom of the list when it comes to states that ratify that.
Well, unless this little thing that came up last week that y'all talked about in the previous half hour with the divorce situation, that could be interesting.
How do you feel about that? Give me your opinion.
I think that's fascinating. I think that's really a backdoor way to help the conversation get to the places that it needs to be held. And if you can equal rights in the history of the United States, if you can do it in one state and you can't do it in another state, that's not fair. So Texas may be dragged into the 20th century and maybe even further before too long. Who knows?
Yeah, but it is the 21st century.
I know, but we're still trying
to get into the 20th century.
A lot of things have not changed yet.
Well, I know that the church your service last Sunday was on divorce, and you had a number of interesting things to say about divorce and about marriage. So, could you share a little bit of that with us? Do you remember what you said?
Well, we can make it up as we go along if we don't. I preach by what's called the lectionary, so the scriptures are prescribed for us, and so the gospel lesson dealt with Jesus' teaching on divorce, which was a way the Pharisees were trying to trap Jesus into dealing with a controversial issue he didn't want to deal with. So very quickly, I basically just reflected on the fact that since we could all come to the communion table, which in Methodism, that's a big word. We like the word come to the table. That's for us a very good symbol of how we understand God's grace.
Mm-hmm.
And the sacrament is the communion. But for us, marriage is a covenant relationship. It is not like the Catholic Church that it is a sacrament. For us, it's a covenant. It's a promise. And at this point in time, we cannot come to the altar to celebrate those things. So we're just at a really different place in time, and we have a lot of things to think through theologically, and we have a lot of things to work through both socially and with people.
Well, the thing to remember, and for people listening to it, and we're talking with Reverend Ernie Turney.
That's right.
Of the Bering Memorial Methodist Church, is that there's a lot of opportunity. You can come to Bering.
You bet.
Any Sunday, come in and join the service, that they're open and welcoming, and you will feel warm and welcome from the moment you step into it. And that's what's important, because some in our community have felt ostracized behind it.
That is one of the things that I noticed first, that there's a lot of woundedness out there, and this church, in this congregation, understands that, and people can come and be welcomed and have a place of healing and wholeness. And that's why it's so much fun being at Bering.
Is there anything that you want to say that we haven't asked that you wanted to say?
Sure. Come see us on Sunday. Short sermons, great music. What else do you want to know?
Well, the question would be, how do I get in touch with you in the church?
Well, ErnieT@Bering.org.
Okay, does it have a website?
We have a website, yes.
And it is?
BeringUMC.org, I believe.
Yes, it is. I looked it up today. So that's right, guys. And the phone number?
713-526-1017.
We've been speaking with Reverend Ernie Turney of Bering Memorial Methodist Church. This is Queer Voices.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. See that one?
10 years ago. That was Dusty Springfield in a song called In Private. This is Queer Voices.
And this is Brian Levinka.
And Jennifer Renee. And in the studio, we have Becky Earle, who is Vice President of Finance for Assisters. And you've got a big event coming up this Sunday evening, Decadent Desserts. Welcome. Yes,
thank
a sweet
you.
Event. A very sweet much event. So. And if you love chocolate and love sweets, that's the place to be on Sunday evening.
Indeed.
So where is it going to be?
This year we're at South Beach. Again, they've been so generous in the past with giving us space. It's South Beach, 4 to 8 p.m. October 11th.
Are there tickets that people can get?
There are. We have tickets online at our website, www.assisters.org.
Spell that, please.
A-S-S-I-S-T-H-E-R-S.
And y'all get that. H-E-R-S.
Yes.
Assist hers.
Yes.
Assist hers.
Play
yes.
There you go.
Well, it's important. People get all lost if they don't.
You're right.
So tell us about this event for people that have not maybe have been to this event before.
Oh, you'll have a great time. This is our annual fundraiser. And what happens is that area restaurants and caterers come and present their wares and their desserts and some savory bites as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not all sweets. And they generously give of their time and their staff and their food. And you come in, and we have raffles. We have an auction this year. We have a few silent auction items and dancing. And primarily, people just get to meet and greet and eat.
I like that. Meet, greet, and eat.
Sounds like a good time to meet.
That's it. Oh.
Very good.
You're talking about that now. Assisters is putting this on, and now for those of people who don't know what Assisters is, it's a volunteer organization, I know, but what do they do?
We've been around since 1996, and we provide what could safely be non-care medical teams to disabled, terminally ill, and chronically ill lesbians, in hopes that we can keep them in their houses and homes as long as possible. And what that means is oftentimes people come in and provide transportation to doctor's appointments, do laundry, food shopping, do house cleaning, pet taking care of, things that some of our clients really find difficult to do and get around and handle.
Now, y'all have been doing this. It's all volunteer. So if somebody wants to get involved and to volunteer, how would they get in touch? Just go to your website?
Well, you can go to the website, and we are so welcoming men and women as volunteers. We do have a few men volunteers.
There you go.
There are such things as male lesbians.
I know a few.
Okay. I'm going to let that roll.
Moving along.
Yes, you can. There is an option to sign up for more information training on the site. We also do outreach at a variety of locations whenever we can. I think, of course, Decadent Dessert will be our huge outreach, but I think our next one will probably be at the Houston Women's Festival.
Ooh.
So throughout the year,
we find
opportunities. I think that's the 24th of October.
Oh, so it's coming up fairly quickly then. Okay.
Don't quote me on that.
Right.
Now, how did you get
involved? Well, we'll have somebody from the festival tell us another week.
Absolutely. That'll be great.
How did you get involved with the sisters?
Actually, a very good friend of mine, Jewel Gray, who I had worked on the switchboard with in the 80s, mm-hmm. had been a volunteer for a long time, and she said, you know, we also have a tools team at Sisters, and what that does is oftentimes we can take care of small fixes. Screen door needs to be fixed. Tile needs to be laid. Fences need to be fixed. So Jewel was a member of this team and asked me if I would come and help. And I said, sure. And that's how I got involved.
And when was that? How long ago?
Oh, wow. 4 or 5 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And so...
So you've been volunteering with them. What does the volunteer do? If I was someone out here listening to the show, and tell me what would draw me to working with the sisters and volunteering.
Well, I think personally.
What was the passion that brought you?
Women helping women.
Right.
Actually, there are not many women organizations in the community other than LHI and some legacy reach out. And And I think that was the opportunity for lesbians to help other lesbians, and anybody to help any other lesbians. I didn't mean only lesbians can volunteer. But that's probably what pulled me, was helping people in the community, because I had been on an AIDS care team in the 80s, and this was very much fashioned around that. And I thought, okay, this is good. This is time. You know, we're all getting older. So.
Right. This is kind of the next generation.
Exactly.
Of, yeah.
Exactly.
How long has Decadent Desserts been around?
This is our ninth year.
Ninth year, okay.
And we plan a very big celebration for our 10th year next year. This is my first year of doing it. Saul Lara, our PR department, has historically done it in the past, as have a variety of people, but this is my first year.
And you've been, what did you do before being Decadent Desserts chair?
Well, as VP Finance, I am the one who writes all the grants asks for all the money.
And you're the, you're the important person, aren't you?
Are you feeling a kind of a slowdown in the grants from like different?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so the fundraiser is very important then.
Yes, and actually we've lowered our ticket prices, taking into consideration the economy hurt. But yes, I am seeing that absolutely in grant numbers and money.
And so again, this is this coming
Sunday at 4 to
October 8. 11th. And where is it going to be?
It is at South Beach Nightclub, which is 810 Pacific Street.
There's a lot of things going on this weekend.
Yes, there is, but this is one on Sunday evening. What else is going on Sunday evening? I think this is it.
Yeah. Well, I'm flying back.
This is the place. Well, Anyway, but this is the place to be. If you're in Houston, this is the place to be on Sunday night.
Absolutely.
Or Sunday afternoon from 4 to 7?
8.
4 to 8. This is where to eat, greet, and meet.
Who doesn't like desserts? I mean, hello, desserts.
Well, I love them myself.
I do too.
I mean, life's too short. Eat dessert first.
Absolutely.
So tell me again. So somebody volunteers, y'all go out, you do these, the assisting, which is there by the name, assisters, for the individuals. Now, is there a certain amount of time? How much time do you have to volunteer? Is there a set amount of time? Or if I only had an hour, is that enough?
Well, people can get on care teams. They can help with committee work, which would be like a decadent dessert.
Yeah.
We have, you know, it's a village to raise a child. It's a village to put this on.
Right.
Normally people get on care teams, and that probably is equivalent to, 3 to 4 hours a month?
Oh, that's not
And we also have our monthly meeting, which is on the second Saturday at Bering, and we have what we call our care circles and time for the volunteers to unwind and talk with one another, schedule their next month, pick up their food cards for their clients, and I'll chat about the programs in a minute, what Decadent Dessert does benefit. And in addition, we provide an education for our volunteers, but it's also open to the public. So we have education subjects on health issues, from finance, you know, advice to long-term care insurance. You know, I've seen it run a whole myriad of stuff.
Are you seeing, like, the younger generation getting involved with this, or is it kind of they're just not there? Or do you see, like, younger people attending these meetings?
Honestly, no.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to reach out to them. You know, it's a different kind of day and age, and people are texting and emailing
Facebook,
and don't seem to be face-to-face as much anymore.
Right.
We do have a few younger volunteers, and so we're with our website, we're really trying to come into the kind of modern age and not put so much emphasis on face-to-face time with volunteers, because a lot of them can electronically process just fine.
Right, right.
But we have a lot of people who really do like to come monthly and see everybody face to face.
Well, it's a whole social aspect.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
It's enough, but if you're only talking about a few hours a month, that's most people can do that if they're interested in doing that. And by the way, we're talking with Becky Earle, who is Vice President of Finance with Assisters. And we're talking about Decadent Desserts, which is going to be this coming Sunday, October 11th. And it's going to be at
South Beach
on Pacific. What is it?
810
Pacific. I'm glad everybody's helping me with this.
So let's talk about
from 4 to 8.
Let's talk about some of the programs that Decadent Desserts will support.
We have primarily four main client programs. We have a food assistance program, and we provide our clients with a $100 food card each month. Mm-hmm. We have a transportation program, which is allocated cost to help our clients get to doctor's appointments should they need to, and supplement taxi vouchers. We have a support team or a support group monthly for them, for those clients, so they can talk among one another and see what's working for them with the organization. And we have case management through Montrose Counseling Center for them, which mm-hmm. is a fantastic. We have a Frances Bueno is our contact there, and she's just incredible.
The organization has been around since 96. What have you been around, maybe you won't be able to answer, what have you seen change over the last 5 years that you've been involved?
Well, of course, our population's getting older. as I'm getting older, unfortunately, a lot of our clients are passing away.
Oh, yeah.
Or they're having to be moved to nursing homes. We're not getting as many younger volunteers. And I don't know if that's a matter of people think, oh, not me, yet.
Right.
You know, but I think we in our 50s are usually thinking, oh, I'm going to have, you know, that may be me, you know, in 20 years. So I think a lot of women are saying, you know, I don't have any family left, or, you know, and I'm going to have to rely on assistors in this organization to hopefully help me stay in my home longer.
Well, I think our community was brought together by the health crisis of the 70s, 80s, and that kind of brought a lot of community organizations together.
Yes.
And now we're kind of seeing that go away somewhat. And I don't know if the next generation is called to action like our generations and before us were.
You're probably right.
And so, you know, it's a huge dilemma because all community organizations are feeling that. You know, everyone's getting older.
Yeah, that's true.
And you're not seeing the 20-somethings, that they have their own little organizations.
It's like virtual communities to them.
Well, and they're all, yes. they're tweeting each other.
Tweeting.
Tweeting. Is it tweeting or twit?
It's you tweet someone.
Tweet someone.
Tweet someone.
I'm sorry, I just don't do it. I don't use Twitter. I'm sorry. But tweeting. Our show does. So
there you
can
go.
get information from Twitter on the show. We can also download the show at iTunes.
Yes, we have a podcast. And yes. We have a Facebook group.
In fact, we are Queer Voices on Twitter. And I keep a running log on there of who we're interviewing and what songs I play and so on.
Well, thank you.
Twitter, yes.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned your website. Talk about that a little bit more.
Well, primarily what's on the website, and we're going to probably look to really revamp that this year.
Mm-hmm.
Saul Lara is taking the lead on that, and we're going to try and just have a different take because we need to, you know, you're looking at websites from a business perspective on, right. on what you want to inform, and, you know, this is your first shot at somebody. It's like your first impression, you know,
yes.
and you really
never get a chance to make another.
You better believe it.
Yeah.
And so I think we're probably going to get a little bit more sophisticated. We do have Facebook. Mm-hmm. We do have Twitter.
Oh.
So you can follow either
what,
of us.
What are some of the other events that Sisters does throughout the year?
Well, we actually, more likely, we help other mm-hmm. organizations
right.
put on their events.
Okay.
We have been so nicely named beneficiaries of so many mm-hmm. wonderful organizations, and we really make an attempt when we're named beneficiary to go out and help them put on their events.
Right.
Like Black Tie, mm-hmm. Halloween Magic,
yeah.
Bunnies on the Bayou.
Are y'all march in the parade, too?
I think we did. I did not this year, but mm-hmm. yes, I believe we have an entry. But it kind of got kind of rowdy, so I know some of the women were a little, you know, there's a little discomfort to, you know, how are we going to fix that, so.
What, yes. marching in the parade?
I think we did we this year? Or, I don't know. Mm. I think we had an entry, definitely. Especially at the festival, we did have an entry there, so in the nonprofit area.
Well, with so much going on, there's a busy Saturday and Sunday with all sorts of events. You need to put on your calendar to finish your Sunday evening at Decadent Desserts, which will benefit a sisters. And I wanted to ask one thing. Is there anything we need to cover that I didn't ask you?
Well, yes, as I've been pointing out, we're going to have a fantastic auction item. It's like a 37-inch screen television with sound surround. Not that I understand what that means, but Best Buy has been so generous in donating that to us. We'll have lots of baskets are beautifully done with all sorts of things in them for raffle. which is, you know, put your raffle ticket being a dollar. So that's a pretty good deal if you simply put one in a bag and then you can buy that. We've got two fantastic, neat bikes that we're going to raffle off. And I suppose this means somebody. They're like got Shimano components. That means somebody who's in really, yeah.
I don't know what that means.
But I've been told people who bike, that's...
That's good.
Very, very important.
Yeah. I know TVs, but I do not know bikes.
Yeah, I don't either.
Bikes,
but,
two-wheel.
They are so neat. So we are really excited because that's going to be a really new type of raffle for us to do.
Now, can people get tickets at the door?
They can.
Or online.
And
where do they go? Assisters.org.
But in addition to that, tickets are on sale at the Houston Buyers Club.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
They are on sale at Acadian Bakery, who is one of our participants.
Oh, I love Katie.
They're on sale at Carter and Cooley Company in the Heights, who is another one of our participants. So those area. And also, we're selling at RMCC on Sundays. This will probably be the last chance on Sunday since the event takes place. We're going to have a very skeleton crew at RMCC selling in their, I think, their hospitality bar.
Oh, okay. Well, that's excellent. We have been talking with Becky Earle, Vice President of Finance with Assisters, and she's Chair of Decadent Desserts this year. And so give us the information again, when and where.
When is this Sunday, October 11th, at 4 to 8 p.m. at South Beach, which is at 810 Pacific Street.
And your website again?
www.assisters.org.
Want to thank you very much for coming this
evening. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. This is Queer Voices.
For a man with some of the most highly touted liberal credentials in the world, opposition to marriage equality has become an untenable position. That's what former U.S. President Bill Clinton told CNN's Anderson Cooper during a wide-ranging September 25th interview. Clinton cited the legal and political issues involved, but said his own personal friendships with same-gender couples had the most impact on his change of heart.
You said you recently changed your mind on same-sex marriage. I'm wondering what you mean by that. Do you now believe that gay people should have full rights to civil marriage nationwide?
I do. I am no longer opposed to that. I think if people want to make commitments that last a lifetime, they ought to be able to do it. I have long favored the right of gay couples to adopt children.
What made you change your mind? I mean, was there one thing? Was it a...
I think what made me change my mind was I looked up one day and I said, look at all this stuff you're for. I've always believed that I've never supported all these the moves of a few years ago to ban gay couples from adoption. Because there are all these kids out there looking for a home. And the standard in all adoption cases is, what is the best interest of the child? And there are plenty of cases where the best interest of the child is to let the gay couple take them and give them a loving home. So I said, you know, I realized that I was, you know, over 60 years old. I grew up in a different time, and I was hung up about the word. I had all these gay friends. I had all these gay couple friends, and I was hung up about it. I decided I was wrong, that our society has an interest in coherence and strength and commitment and mutually reinforcing loyalties. And if gay couples want to call their union marriage, and a state agrees, and several have now, or a religious body will sanction it, and I don't think the state should be able to stop the religious bodies from saying it, I don't think the rest of us should get in the way of that. I think it's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Former U.S. President Bill Clinton explained his new lease on marriage rights to CNN's Anderson Cooper.
There's nothing so international as a powerful idea. I'm Edmund White. It is the overwhelming international flavor of the lesbian and gay rights movement that has proved so powerful over the past couple of decades. And one radio program has been there to record, to inform, and to entertain. So please keep listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine on this station.
Jazzmaster Billy Strayhorn, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Billy Strayhorn is best known for his long collaboration with Duke Ellington. He arranged the theme, Take the A-Train, for Ellington's orchestra, as well as Lush Life, Satin Doll, and Johnny Come Lately. He was born in 1915 and raised in Pittsburgh. In high school, he was devoted to classical music, playing a piano he bought with his own hard-earned money. Then his life changed. He found jazz. Without any formal training, he began composing and before long proved a remarkable musical talent. In 1940s New York, he lived openly with fellow musician Aaron Bridgers. Strayhorn's talents were by then well known in the black musical community, which may explain why he avoided the spotlight and let Ellington receive credit for their collaborative work. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Gizbo.
Are you signed up for our emailed This Way Out updates? We send them out every few weeks, briefly reviewing recent and previewing upcoming programming and dishing some behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show. We also send out weekly email messages describing the specific content of each program. All you have to do to receive one or both of these messages is email tworadio@aol.com. And be assured that we don't share or sell your email address or anything about you to anyone else, and we never will. Again, to receive the occasional This Way Out updates or our weekly program information messages, ask for one or both by name when you email tworadio@aol.com. That's tworadio@aol.com.
The word character could have been coined to describe Elliot Tiber. His book was the inspiration for Taking Woodstock, a cinematic celebration of the landmark cultural event. Oscar-winning director Ang Lee's movie makes Elliot a character in that sense of the word, too, portrayed by actor-comedian Dimitri Martin. This Way Out Entertainment reporter Steve Pride got some behind-the-scenes dish from Tiber about the movie and the legendary concert itself.
Ang Lee's film, Taking Woodstock, is about a young man named Elliot Tiber. So, yes, there is a real Elliot Tiber.
Yes, I'm here.
I am so excited to talk to you. I love the movie. The book is even better.
Well, thank you.
So let's get this out of the way. How did you save Woodstock?
Well, the Woodstock Festival was being canceled out in a nearby town because the local redneck population, the guys who drink beer and shoot Bambi's mother, put a notice in the paper that they didn't want their town overrun with 10,000 drug addicts, homosexuals, and dirty lesbians because they would rape the cows on Main Street. Why the lesbians had to be dirty, I don't know. I'm a vegetarian. But that was the situation. I was 25 miles north in the town of Bethel, and I had a broken-down hotel called the Monaco with my parents. On weekends, during a week, I was a successful designer in Manhattan, lived in the village. And so for 10 years, I had a music and arts festival on my property, and I had a permit for that festival because I was president of the Chamber of Commerce by default. We didn't have any commerce. So I had this permit, and when I saw the announcements that they didn't have any permit anymore, I called with the three magic words. I said, I have a permit. So Mike Lang, the producer, flew to my place in a helicopter. He was there in 15 minutes. My 33 actors that I had in my barn got naked, I don't know why, and painted on their bodies, peace, love, and music. And the helicopter arrived. First thing he asked for was a permit. So I sold it to him for the dollar that I paid for it. And that was the beginning of it. And my festivals were a total bust. Nobody ever showed up. Only one person in the 10 years that it came, and that was Max Jaska, who was my milkman. And he got the eggs and cheese and milk donated to the actors. So I told Mike Lang, if you rent my rooms, I have 72 rooms, depends how you count them, and if you hire my actors, and I have 15 acres of ground, and here's the permit, and let's do it. So he said, it's a deal. And I took them to my 15 acres of ground there, which was all mud, really cesspool mud. And we had a mascot, a goat, that had to pull the helicopter out of the mud. And they were about to leave, and my heart fell out. And I said, wait a minute, my milkman up the road has about 600 or 700 acres of beautiful, open, rolling countryside. And so we went to Max, and Max said, sure, you and your festival, so how about $50 a day? And then they said, sure, and they paid him in cash. And, of course, the next day they found out there'd be 25,000 people, and the price went up to $50,000 and then to 100, as we saw there were really 100,000 tickets sold. So I'm the gay man who saved Woodstock.
Well, one of the things that struck me in the movie was I had assumed that Ang Lee had exaggerated about your parents' motel, and then I read your book and I realized he was being kind. Tell me about the Almonico Resort.
Well, the place was falling apart. We didn't have much money. I spent all my salary investing in the Almonico. My dream was to make that Bond Theater work, and I was a designer, but I wanted to write comedy and perform as a humorist, and so I couldn't do auditions. I was terrified of that. So by having my Bond Theater, I wouldn't have to audition. But nobody came. We were doing, had 33 actors. We were doing Shakespeare and Beckett. We did in the nude only because our goat was the mascot, ate all the costumes. We started doing the nude, but nobody showed up for that either. And we didn't have doorknobs or air conditioning, all of that. And it was really a disaster, and the bank was about to take it all away. So I didn't have any spiritual feelings about a music festival for, as far as that goes. I wanted to rent the rooms. That's why I called them, because the bank was going to take the place away.
One of the things I love in the book is that you actually tried to make it a little grander than it was. I mean, you had plastic boxes in the air conditioning windows and phones, but they just weren't connected.
Yeah, well, a drunk discontent from the phone company stopped by a couple of years before with 500 phones, and he wanted to sell them. We didn't have money to hook anything up, so my mother gave him beers and her rotten cooking and then $5, and he gave us the phones and sort of stapled them to the walls and made a switchboard with Christmas lights in it just blinking. It didn't do anything, and I was an artist, so I painted a lot of signs, and signs said, well, pardon our appearance while we install phones or while we install air conditioning. I put up signs that said, on this site soon 2,000 rooms with parking for 10,000 cars and health clubs. It was all craziness because I was just desperate, and I always had a sense of humor, and I've always lived my life through humor, through Jewish humor.
There are a couple of characters in the book, one in particular that is also in the movie. Tell us about the Baroness von Wilma.
If you wanted to film the book as written, you'd have to have a 50-hour movie and 2,000 characters. So they narrowed it down to 54 people. So Wilma's a combination of two or three friends, people that stormed into the place. And Wilma is a cross-dressing guy who is a grandfather, and he had... his ex-lover was my ex-lover in the city, and he came by to, he didn't know about anything, he came by to see if he could help, and he decided to become security. He was a tough Marine in Korea, so he formed a patrol to help keep the rednecks away, because they were painting faggot on the walls and swastikas and all this terrible stuff. There was even a sign hanging there across the road that says, no dogs, no Jews, and I had never experienced any of that kind of stuff. So Wilma was like some of the other characters, a combination. I had three sisters. They made one sister in the movie. But my mother and father are depicted very accurately by Imelda Staunton, the British actress, who was in Sense and Sensibility and Harry Potter movies, and Henry Goodman. And I was consultant to the film, so I gave notes of how they should speak and look and dress and all of that, and they followed it, and I cried when I watched the movie. Each time I've seen it 8 times now, because it was looking like my parents were both dead, looking as if they're alive again. It was just amazing. Because Dimitri has nothing to do with me. He's a Catholic and straight, and I'm a Jewish gay. And I don't understand that casting, so it's just... But it's Hollywood movies. I'm just in heaven, and my whole life is overturned at my age now. Well, I look like Brad Pitt since this is radio, I can tell you that. And
But not the Brad Pitt in The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. The young Thelma and Louise Brad Pitt, right?
Yeah. And it's just wonderful because I... can I tell you how I got to Ang Lee?
Yeah, go ahead.
Without an agent, without a lawyer. I was in 07 when the hardcover came out. I went to San Francisco on a talk show. I forget the TV show name it was. And the other guest was Ang Lee. So in the green room, I said how wonderful I thought the director was, like Fellini or Pasolini. Just a genius, and I meant that. And he said, what are you doing here? So I was wearing my Woodstock t-shirt, and I said, have you heard of Woodstock? Yeah, I was a teenager in Taiwan with long hair and bell-bottom jeans, and police came door to door, and then they arrested you if you didn't cut your hair or your jeans. And then a short while later, Woodstock happened, and boy, it just brought freedom to me, and it affected the whole world. Why do you ask? I said, I'm the guy who saved Woodstock. And I said, I love your films, but this everybody dies. They're so sad. They're brilliant, but everybody dies. Wouldn't you like to do a comedy? And he giggled. Said, I sure would if I could find one. And I said, how about mine? And I gave him the book, and I pitched for 2 minutes what this story was about. And he said to me, you're one of the funniest guys I have ever met in my whole life. If this book is as funny as the story you're telling me, I want to make this movie. And 2 months later, I got a call and come have a meeting with Focus Features and James Seamus, who was going to adapt it into the screenplay. I had written movies before in Europe, but they don't recognize French credits in America. They only care about Hollywood. So I had no problem with James Seamus writing it.
I had read somewhere that the film you wrote in Europe was one of the entries in the Academy Awards.
Oh, yes. It was the official Belgian entry in the Academy Awards for Best Foreign Film. It was a finalist. Unfortunately, we had enough votes to get a complete nomination, but we didn't have enough money to my partner Andre and I, who's a Belgian director, that we did this movie, and we didn't have enough money to play the film in Hollywood. It would have been $10,000 in those days, and we didn't have it. So we did get to be a finalist, and that was incredible for my first film.
Pride will continue taking Woodstock with Elliot Tiber.
I didn't know what the word gay meant. I didn't know what homosexual meant. I've been doing funny stuff since I was about 10.
Next time on This Way Out. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Sherry Lung, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Giz Bow, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Richie Havens performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is supported by voluntary program acquisition payments by our affiliate stations and through donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, hear our podcasts, read this week's news wrap, and subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on WWUH West Hartford, Connecticut, 2YOU Tamworth, New South Wales, KEOS College Station, Texas, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. For the 1,123rd time, please do stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
It was a great show tonight, wasn't it, Brian?
It's always a great show, but tonight was especially good.
Yes, it was. I wanted to announce, I wasn't here last Monday, but I want to announce this is the 12th consecutive week that Larry Marshall, president of the HISD school board, has not returned my phone call.
Have you been holding your breath?
No. I have given up on it. But now Suzanne in the office who works in there, she has been trying to get him to make an appointment with me. I don't think he'll ever return my phone call, but that's neither here nor there. But we are making headway. I hope over the next few weeks I'll be able to make an announcement that we've made some headway with HISD.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
But what's going to happen next week?
Well, I am not thinking past this weekend because I'm headed off to D.C.
Oh, you're going to be gone.
I'll be back on Monday.
You'll be back on Monday. And, first of all, we have Melissa Noriega first at 9 o'clock, and then city council member Melissa Noriega. And then you're going to do a recap?
I'm going to recap the march, and I'm going to try to get some people that have never been to the march before and kind of get their impressions about you know this movement and our rights and equality.
And then we'll have the Gay Men's Chorus.
Yes.
We'll be here again, and that's for next week. So please,
who
tune
do we
in.
Have on tonight?
And of course, we will always have News Wrap. We have to want to thank David Elliott, who always calls in the first of the month. I want to thank him for coming on. Then City Council Member Sue Lovell.
And Mayor Pro Tem.
Mayor Pro Tem was here, and thank her so much for coming on. Then we had Reverend Ernie Turney, minister of Bering Memorial Methodist Church, was here talking about GLBT outreach. And then, of course, we had Becky Earle, Vice President of Finance with Assisters, and talking about decadent desserts for this weekend, this Sunday night. And, hey, it was fun.
It was fun, and be sure to tune in to us next week.
Next week. This is Queer Voices.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston, with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
In keeping with KPFT's mission of bringing the voices of the community to you, here is one of your candidates in the upcoming election for local station board.
Hello, my name is Robert Mark, and I am a candidate for the KPFT Pacifica local station board. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri before moving to Texas, where community-based talk radio was invented by a gentleman by the name of Robert Hyland back in the 1950s. I love radio, and I love locally produced community service radio, networking with organizations to further the mutual aims of the station and those organizations. And I would appreciate your vote for the local station board.
That was a statement by Robert Mark. For complete candidate statements and more information about all of your candidates for the local station board, please visit kpft.org. The future of KPFT and the entire Pacifica network now rests upon the participation of our listener members. Let your voice be heard with your vote. This is KPFT Houston.
KPFT 90.1 FM will celebrate another laid-back October in Houston with its Heat Be Gone yard sale at 419 Lovett Boulevard. On Saturday, October 10th, between 9 a.m. and 2 p.m., volunteers and staff will be in the backyard at the station selling books, CDs, DVDs, and some great used vinyl for bargain prices. So forget about another day at the mall ice rink waiting for a breeze from the Zamboni. Slap on the last of that sunscreen, slip on some flip-flops, and come see us at 419 Lovett Boulevard on Saturday, October 10th, between 9 a.m. and 2 p.m. at KPFT.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.